Hi, this is Elizabeth Collins from New Zealand Vegan Podcast. You can find me at nzveganpodcast.blogspot.com. I'm in Auckland, New Zealand, and right now you're listening to Coexisting with Non-Human Animals.
I know the human being and fish can coexist peacefully.
Vegetarian.
Vegan.
Yeah,
well. Let's get it right.
You used the word animals, but I suppose what you should have said is non-human animals. If you want to make the world a better place, take a look at yourself, then make a
change. Hello and welcome to another episode of Coexisting with Non-Human Animals. This episode I have three stories. One about rabbit hunting, another chapter in the Alan Craver saga, the man who owned 20 dairy farms and had starving animals slowly dying, who had polluted rivers with animal waste, and who owed $200 million to banks. That Alan Craver. The last story, possibly the largest, is about a supposed outrage about how a lobster was killed on a New Zealand cooking show. I've seen basically every act that can be done to an animal. I've watched Earthlings more times than I can remember, but I respect my friends who don't want to see or hear about animals being killed. So I've left that story till last. I have some quotes from the Backlash clip I will read, and then, with a warning, I'll play the clip. If you don't want to hear the 10-minute clip talking about the Backlash, how these people feel about animal feelings or lack thereof, you can end this episode there. The actual killing of the lobster takes about 5 seconds and it's near the end of the clip. The clip was played on national TV. It doesn't have any blood or screaming, that we can hear at least. It's meant to be about the animal welfare way to kill an animal, the quote, humane way. I absolutely am against an animal being killed for our pleasure. I'll cover this clip from an animal rights standpoint. Before I start this episode, I'd like to say hello to Justin, age 4, who might be listening with Barbara DeGrand, whose podcast can be found by searching Veganacious on the iTunes Store or at veganacious.com. I'd also like to invite any vegans listening, from any part of the world, to send me a clip about themselves, how it is to be vegan where they live. It would be great to have other people's voices on my show, to show how there are vegans in every part of the world. If you'd like to talk for 30 seconds, a minute, or longer, I'd love to have you on. You can email me at jaywontdart@gmail.com, jaywontdart@gmail.com. If I receive any clips, I'll be happy to play them. I'd also like to mention something odd I found in a movie. I've been ripping DVDs to my new iMac. I have most of my DVD collection saved on this computer now, just for my personal viewing, and while watching the James Bond movie Die Another Day, I noticed something strange. Die Another Day might be my favourite Bond movie, although I'm not a huge Bond fan. It has an invisible Aston Martin, North Korea trying to take over the world, a palace made of ice, a giant space weapon, and a cool intro song by Madonna, who also has an appearance in the movie. During one of the car chases with said Aston Martin with the potential to appear invisible, it seems like a small animal, a mouse, runs through the shot. It can be seen at roughly 1 hour 37 minutes and 15 seconds through the movie. It moves right in the middle of the frame. It's small and dark against a white ice background. We see it just before Bond's car drives past, although the scene changes, and we don't see what happens to the little mouse. I'm quite sure it could have been okay. There would have been plenty of space between the little mouse and the car, which was going to zoom past it. Using a free software tool I'd like to mention, Chimusoft's Capture Me tool for Mac computers, I took a video screenshot of the scene. I've uploaded this to YouTube, being played back frame by frame for the second that the mouse appears. I was really pleased to finally get a free video screenshot tool. I've made a small donation to the developer, and I hope anyone listening to this episode gets the program, Capture Me, if they want to record similar things. I'll include a link to the frame-by-frame YouTube video in my show notes. I mention this little mouse because it seems so odd. There's this epic car chase between a Jaguar and an Aston Martin, through a giant palace made of ice, and a mouse is clearly seen moving about on the ice. I'm sure there are wild mice in the area, and this one was just minding its own business. I think it's very likely the mouse was fine, But it's odd to find it in the released movie. I mean, it's just a car driving around in a scene, it just makes a little turn. It's not like an expensive CG shot that they'd have to reshoot. I checked IMDb, and nobody seems to have reported the little mouse before. Perhaps I could be the first person to find it. I've submitted it as a goof to IMDb, and while I won't get credit if it's accepted, I think it would be fun to say I noticed the little wild mouse in that scene. Of course, that's assuming it is a little mouse. I've uploaded a screenshot, a frame-by-frame video, and mentioned how you can watch 1 hour, 37 minutes and 15 seconds through the movie to notice the little mouse near the bottom center of the frame. Backing me up that it's a mouse, I've got comments from Desmond. Yeah, suppose it's moving, so it's definitely some kind of rodent. Nicola? Well, I just showed my brother too, and he said it's definitely a mouse, laugh out loud. I think it's quite likely. And George? Just my 2 cents, it has to be a mouse or some sort of rodent because what else could it be? So, no matter what the comments on YouTube might say, at least I've got 3 people who agree with me that it's a little mouse. Rabbit shooting. The article begins. Run, rabbits, run. Shooters will line up Centro Otago pests in their crosshairs this weekend for the 19th Alexandra Lions Club Great Easter Bunny Hunt. Organisers expect to rid the region of thousands of rabbits, plus a few stoats, ferrets and possums. More than 400 hotshots convened in Alexandra on Thursday before setting out to their designated hunting grounds for a 24-hour shoot. Competitors, divided into 39 teams of 12, were allocated a backcountry patch and a draw supervised by police, who also delivered a firearm safety briefing. Invercargill-based hunter Bruce Donald, whose team, Cuniculus Terminators, won the 2009 shoot, said about 2/3 of the cull was done overnight. The hunt's success depended on the luck of the draw, he said. If you get the right block, then you're in with a fair chance. Ray Moffat of Gore said this year could be different because of the increase in rabbit populations in Otago and Southland. His team, Southern Hopper Stoppers, were gunning for first place after 4 successive years in the number 2 spot and would be happy with anything but bloody second, he said. Almost 15,000 rabbits were culled last year. The rabbit population in central Otago has increased after a dry spring and summer, which makes for an optimum breeding season, and a decline in the efficiency of the introduced rabbit, okay, give me a pass on this next word, hemorrhagic disease. I've grown up around rabbits before, and have never understood how they are so incredibly dangerous. To hold actual contests about how many animals a team can kill is pretty sick. These are grown men, with guns, acting like a bunch of kids, with guns, joking about killing the Easter bunnies, with guns. In New Zealand, almost nobody has a gun, only recreational hunters, people who enjoy killing animals. Our police officers almost never have guns, although they have recently got tasers, an electrical stun weapon. In parts of New Zealand, such as where I live, seasonal hunting can be a big event. We have mai mais, which are traditionally grass huts where hunters shoot from. These have evolved into corrugated iron shanties, and there are always little contests to see who can have the best mai mai. Some have televisions running hot and cold water, most have reclining chairs for the overweight slobs to sit in, and of course there's a cold place, possibly a refrigerator, for the beer. Now, there's always safety briefings about being responsible. Now fellas, don't go drinking and shooting. But pretty much every video I've seen of hunting involves alcohol in some sense. I remember a recent news piece about a hunting season opening for ducks, and there were beer cans visible in the shot. I don't think all hunters drink, but from what I've seen of Mai Mai culture, it's an integral part. I've been watching my DVD collection of Little Britain, a BBC comedy. In the Little Britain USA series set in America, there are 2 hunters who act very serious about killing tiny animals. In the piece I watched last night, they get all excited about shooting a mouse and then a wasp. It takes 12 or more shots from a handful of different guns to take out the wasp. These trophy kills are then roasted together over a fire in celebration of the hunter's skills. I think this is a very accurate portrayal of many hunters. I wouldn't consider it comedy, though. Many people enjoy shooting guns, and if they can be brainwashed into thinking that they're superheroes by hanging out with other men, in the bush, killing animals that weigh 1/100 their weight, then they will feel great about themselves. So, we have these rabbits that are the biggest threat to humanity in New Zealand by the way they're built up to be evil pests. How do we deal with the bunny menace? Why? With viruses that kill rabbits, released into the wilderness, and by having contests where a bunch of yahoos with guns drive about the country in the dead of night, trying to beat the other teams of yahoos with guns driving about the country in the dead of night with guns. I especially feel angry that the newspaper story has so many jokes in it. It began, "Run, rabbit, run." I know it's absolutely an accepted event, but shouldn't reporters be at least a little like that wonderful Fox Network, all fair and balanced? Run, rabbit, run. I don't know if my friends listening from other countries know the children's song. I was reminded by the article. Like many New Zealand things, the native Māori language versions sound better. More spiritual, I guess. Even childish lyrics sound meaningful. The song in Māori goes, Oma rapati, oma rapati, oma, oma, oma. Oma rapati, oma rapati, oma, oma, oma. Of course, the English version is, run rabbit, run rabbit, run, run, run. Run rabbit, run rabbit, run, run, run. It holds true for our national anthem, which is often said not to invoke passion, apart from the Māori verse and the haka, a war dance. E iora atua, o nā iwi mātoura. Ata whakarohona, me aroha noa. Something like that. And the English first verse goes, God of nations, at thy feet, in the bonds of love we meet. Hear our voices, we entreat, God defend our free land. Which I, as an atheist, hate singing. I went to Catholic schools, and at one the motto was, rely on God. What a great attitude. Hey God, mate, can I borrow $10? I'll pay you back next Tuesday when I get paid. Cheers, bro. Just to wrap up this episode of Māori Songs Pronounced by Someone Who Cannot Speak the Language, here's a clip of a song I learnt about the different colours. I love hearing another New Zealander's accent in recordings. So everyone listening at home can sing along. I've included a link to a site where you can see the lyrics for more Māori songs. I wish we were more like the UK schools I mentioned last episode, where children are taught to respect even the smallest animals. Singing traditional folk songs encouraging rabbits to run away from danger would be of great benefit to this cause. Come to think of it, that reminds me of MJ's song Beat It. Perhaps we could do a mashup of Oma Rapiti and Beat It. Oma Rapiti. Run Rabbit. Maybe I can leave that to someone more talented. Crafer Farms, bought by Chinese. Crafer on benefit. You might remember my first episode as in episode 1, not episode 0. On my first actual episode, I covered the Crafer family dairy farm, which was in the news about having starving animals. The main member of the family, Alan Crafer himself, was quite a character. No matter what happened on his farms, it was always someone else's fault. It was someone else's fault that the animals on his farm hadn't been fed, but had been left to starve to death. Apparently the farmers were tipped off that an inspection was going to happen at the farm, and supposedly most of the sickest animals were killed by hand, so they wouldn't be seen. With all the effluent or animal waste that had been dumped into rivers, that was someone else's fault, and we shouldn't be so strict with our laws. When his farm empire was found to be like said cow poop, being eroded away by a tidal wave consisting of $200 million New Zealand dollars in debt to banks, Crafer claimed he was okay, or that somehow reporters knew more about his business than he did. It was always someone else's fault, a conspiracy against him and his family. Now his 20 farms have been put into receivership, and it seems like Chinese business people will be buying the Crafer farms. This has gotten some people very angry. The topic of overseas investors buying New Zealand's assets has long been an issue. The Green Party has come out about the Crafer farms being sold to overseas interests. Frankly, it doesn't affect me who owns a bunch of farms. What was interesting is a new story about Alan Crafer applying for a benefit, welfare, living off money from the government. Quote, after 40 years on the farm, former dairy giant Alan Crafer has applied for the dole. Mr. Crafer said the family had trust, but any money in them was tied up by receivers. He claimed the farms and receivership were being run so inefficiently by the receivers, it has eaten up any equity we had. I've linked to the full story, but it's amazing to learn more about Alan Crafer. All through every story, he blames someone else. He can't afford a lawyer, because all of his assets were taken away, because, you know, he was kinda a little bit, you know, a couple $100 million in debt. And he can't get legal aid because he won't show his accounting records, or he can't anyway, because his accountants haven't been paid money owed to them by Crafer. Yes, for Alan Crafer, owner of 20 dairy farms, everything is a conspiracy to get him, everyone is out to get him. I'll paraphrase the quote above. I don't have any money because I had a minor problem of owing $200 million and so everything I had was taken from me. And now those farms are being so poorly run that they won't be making much money, and so the farms that are no longer owned by me will not be making me any money, and so now I need to go on the benefit and live off other people. I joined the animal welfare group SAFE's protest about animals being used in zoos, and as I stood there with a banner after working 6 days of the week, I was told to get a real job by a man who was probably retired. Farmers especially have this brilliant idea that all vegans who disagree with what they do to animals must be on the dole or living off money from the government. Well, now Alan Crafer, former owner of 20 farms, $200 million in debt, is himself living on the dole, on welfare, not earning his keep. Lobster cooked on MasterChef show. Backlash. I've kept this story for last, as I want to play the 10-minute clip about how to kill a lobster, quote, humanely. I understand if anyone doesn't want to hear the clip. I've taken some quotes that I'd like to read about what is said, but I respect anyone who doesn't want to hear the clip. I'll mention when I'm going to play it, and if you like, you can end the episode there, and you'll hear me again next episode. In New Zealand, a lot of New Zealanders call lobsters crayfish. It's a weird little name that only New Zealanders seem to use. I prefer to say lobster, if it's good enough for every other country in the world, if it's a more technical name, it's just as easy to use the correct name. I'll use both names, lobster and crayfish, about this story though. On a New Zealand cooking show, a woman killed a lobster or two by throwing them into boiling water. She had to weigh down the pot lids because they would of course struggle. The judges on this reality TV show were not impressed, and they said she had killed the lobster in an inhumane way. She and her teammates were apparently sent off the show, mostly for other reasons, I believe, but she showed up on the close-up show the next day. I'll play that clip after talking about what happens in it. I hope you'll listen to the clip afterwards, but you don't have to. These are not exact quotes, just what I quickly jotted down while listening to the clip. Always respect your ingredients, especially alive ingredients. This is a living, breathing animal, a monster. When you kill a crayfish, you need to do it quickly and efficiently. Try to chase a sheep around the back paddock and kill it. You'll have the toughest piece of meat on the earth. This animal is 4 years old, and it's a beautiful thing. Chill it down, and so when you put in the knife, it doesn't feel it. It's about giving animals the respect they deserve. I saw you put those live, innocent crayfish into boiling water. Yeah, right. So when we kill an animal by boiling it, it was innocent and didn't deserve the death penalty. But when we kill it humanely, it was guilty? We like to eat these beautiful things, so we have to do it somehow. I don't mind to give it a whack, so to speak. About people who had complained, and apparently threatened the woman who boiled the lobster with violence, she says in the later clip, "It's not okay to be violent to crayfish, but it's okay to be violent to people." I'm glad she mentioned that. If people who love and care for animals, big and small, and yet are violently abusive to people, how does that make animal rights activists look? Not good, in my opinion. A vegan would have you believe a bunch of celery has feeling. I have to interrupt there. Ethical vegans disagree with hurting anyone who can feel pain. If we thought celery could suffer, we wouldn't eat celery. Or did you mean that we can ascribe feelings to any random item, such as celery? I think it's pretty clear that a lobster is a random animal. Feels pain for no other reason than how you needed to put heavy items on top of the pot of boiling water. Why? Because it would be moving about, trying to live. You had its antenna jammed between the pot and the lid, and needed to force the lid down. Try and boil celery. It won't desperately try and escape the hell you've put it through. But thank you for taking a cheap shot at vegans. When the supposed humane way is performed, the tail of the lobster is held with a tea towel over it, and the very large chef's knife cuts about the length of a finger through to the front. The lobster moves for a second or two, which we are told is rigor mortis. You know, when a dead body goes hard. That's the term the expert chef used to describe an animal that would, in my opinion at least, be feeling pain after we've sliced through a very large part of its body, including between his or her eyes. It's true that the lobster only seems to jerk about for a second or two, although parts of it are sort of trembling afterwards. It hadn't been moving at all, really, while it was on the table for that whole clip. I guess it had been stunned for that whole time. Could it feel anything at all? I'd imagine it was close to death before they killed it. The chef actually says, you can put it in the freezer where it will go off to sleep. I'm trying not to swear here, but sleep? You think if you throw a human being into a freezer naked that they'd go to sleep? Hell no, they'd go into a coma, if anything. They'd be closer to death than just sleeping. That's a feel-good word. Okay, honey, now time to put Mr. Lobster off to bed, in the freezer, before we eat him. He's had a great life, and now it's time for him to go to heaven, by way of our digestive tract. I suppose the lobster hadn't been moving because it was in a coma-type state. I get really upset when people don't look after their ingredients. After saying this, a close-up is shown, and many parts of the lobster's body are moving. Its feelers, if you will, are moving, and at least one leg is twitching. These could be just death spasms, as someone who eats animals might say, or these could be a dying animal's last painful moments. I am not an expert in what animals feel when you've just put a knife the same length as their body through their head with great pressure. I certainly would expect an animal to feel pain. They've died. They've given up their life so you can walk upright on the planet. Any good chef respects their ingredients. Mr. or Miss Lobster certainly didn't give their life to you. You needed to put weight on the pot lid so it couldn't try and knock the lid off in its death struggle. Animals don't happily slit their own throats for us to eat them. They want to live. You took the life of that animal. Something else that's mentioned, that if you are out in the wild, it's still okay to boil a lobster alive in a pot, using the Jane Goodall excuse of, it's too hard to do the right thing. How could you be disgusted at what a young woman did to a lobster if you'd happily do it yourself when you were out at sea? That reminds me of the Eric Marcus, Gary Francione debate, where Peter Singer had been mentioned, having said eating animals was morally justifiable, and Eric Marcus believed that something could be morally justifiable, but not the right thing to do. The piece ends with the host Sainsbury saying, that's the most humane way, because they are certainly too yummy not to eat. We're going to be arguing about where this one's going next. Of course, all three people in the clip are laughing at the end. To repeat a quote from above, we like to eat these beautiful things, so we have to do it somehow. And that is why I don't support animal welfare. We hear from large welfare groups, oh, well, they will be killed anyway, so let's try and make them do it a bit better, and maybe we can have some mention that vegetarians are cool, tucked away somewhere on our website. I don't care how they kill a lobster, or as we in New Zealand say, a crayfish. It's wrong to hurt an animal. It's wrong to throw an animal into very hot water, and to force the lid down with heavy objects to stop it trying to crawl out. It's just as wrong to thrust a large knife through its exoskeleton and pull the blade through its head, exiting between his or her eyes. I've never eaten lobsters before. I find it hard to believe something so, for lack of a better word, freaky-looking, could taste, quote, yummy. But even if they do, I think it's terrible to hurt an animal. I'll play the clip now. If you don't want to hear it, you can end the episode here. There's no creepy music, there's no blood, even if you could see what happens. But I respect people who don't want anything to do with an animal being killed.
Reality TV can be brutal, but never more so than last night's MasterChef. And no, I'm not talking about the fact that three contestants were sent home. I'm talking about the cold-blooded killing of a crayfish.
Karen, tell me, how did you kill the crayfish?
We just put them into boiling water. Gone.
So how would you feel about if I put a big pot of boiling water on and I threw you in there?
RSPCA is going to hate me, but as far as I'm concerned, they're crayfish. It needs to die. We're about to eat them. What does it matter how they die?
Crayfish, not humans.
I don't feel guilty at all. Crayfish don't have feelings.
They're bred to be killed.
So you're the team of crayfish assassins. I saw you put those innocent crayfish, those live innocent crayfish, straight into boiling water. Apart from the fact that you always respect your ingredients, you especially respect ingredients that are alive.
Blue team, that was a disappointing effort today. Not your best work, and unfortunately, you're all leaving the competition.
The Auckland SPCA today, as Karen predicted, endorsed the judge's verdict. Bob Kerridge saying boiling just wasn't on. Well, the crayfish assassin and latest master chef of Vic D, Karen Fisk, is with me, as is the guest, her harshest critic, of course, the guest judge last night, and top chef himself, Peter Thorney from Kermadec. You get a bit of, I mean, you had a bit of hostile reaction to this, haven't you?
I did have some hostile reaction, yes, which was to be expected, but I didn't know any better. Crayfish has never graced my table at home before, so I didn't know.
But people on Facebook threatening to do you violence and that sort of
stuff. Yeah, there was, you know, people don't like you being violent to a crayfish, but it's okay to be violent to people, so.
Okay. No, so you just didn't, I mean, you just didn't know?
Simply didn't know. Didn't know at all.
And look, you look and see the reaction to the story today. There's a lot of people still saying, boiling's the best way, I've done it for years and years and years.
Well, boiling's the way when you're a New Zealander and you're on the beach, you have your batch, you go and put a few cray pots out, you light a fire on the beach, you put a pot of water on, and it's still done. But it is not the humane way.
And you were genuinely shocked. I mean, this wasn't just some hamming up for the show.
No.
You were quite shocked.
No, I'm genuinely shocked. You know, working with live ingredients, you, as Ray McVinney says, you give them the respect that they deserve. I mean, this here is a living, breathing animal.
A monster.
It is a monster. And you know, when you kill a crayfish, you need to do it quickly and efficiently.
See, one of the things people say, and again, looking at the reaction to this thing today, they're saying, oh, look, you know, if you don't boil them, if you freeze them, it makes it tough. It affects the taste of the meat. Now, you pride yourself on what you put on the table.
Yeah.
Do you believe that it does affect the way that it's killed can ruin the taste of crayfish?
Oh, of course it can. If you chase it around the floor, like on the first clip on MasterChef, you saw them taking the crayfish out of the tanks and them falling on the floor. That, to me, is unacceptable. It's like chasing a sheep around the back paddock and trying to kill it. You have the toughest piece of meat on the earth. So the way you kill it is very, very important. There are two ways. You either put it in the freezer and let it go to sleep, and so it just dozes off, bring it out, and you still have to put the knife down through the cerebral cortex to kill it instantly. But, you know, you like to eat crayfish, that's the way you do
and,
it.
And, of course, for some people, putting the knife down through the cerebral cortex is just not honest. I mean, they either don't have the stomach for it, or sometimes the strength, because something like this, I'd imagine, could be quite a job.
Oh, this is huge. This is tough. This animal is probably about, I don't know, maybe 4 years old. And it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. And of course we had the Rock Lobster Council today said, I didn't know we had a Rock Lobster Council, we do though.
Wow.
They said chill them down first because they go moribund, which is
That's
a lovely
it.
Word.
They go to sleep.
This one is supposed to be like signs of waking up, but this one has been, we have followed their advice, chilled this down.
That's right.
And that way when you insert the knife, it doesn't actually feel anything. So where are you going to be aiming for, Peter?
We'll go, the two eyes are here, so we come right back to the back of the shell and come normally about one finger in, and you take the knife and you push the knife hard down to the point, and then you'll pull it straight through.
So you find your middle spot, but you come right to the back before the tail starts.
If you look at him, he's got a little horn in the middle, come straight back and through there.
Okay, if we're talking about, you know, the ethics in the kitchen, if you like, the same thing would apply, what, to crabs as well? Anything live?
Anything alive. It applies to crabs, to live prawns, it applies to all those things that are alive. It's about giving the animal the respect that it deserves.
Is it true that they eat them live in Japan, or is that just some urban myth?
No, it's true. I lived in Sapporo and Hokkaido, and they eat them alive. And it's not good. It's another animal that is really difficult in the kitchen. It's an eel, and you have to skin the eel alive. So it's not good.
And this is the business you want to get into.
Yeah, but we like to eat these beautiful things, so you have to do it somehow.
You could manage doing this? I mean, would it bother you putting a knife into it, Karen?
I think, I want to do cook cray more later on in life, so I don't mind to give it a whack, so to speak.
give it a whack.
But going back to, last night's show, you just thought that was when you thought, right, the cray's got to be prepared, straight into the pot was... And you didn't think it would... You thought it was humane even doing that. You didn't think it would in terms of hurting the cray.
You know, everybody has their different feelings about animals' feelings, how their minds and stuff. And I'm still growing up. I'm still learning things as well. And that, for me, was just the way I had only ever heard of how to do it. So
when Peter basically gave you guys a serve, the whole team, how did the team react? How did you feel about it?
Well, it was hard because we did feel
should I move
bad.
The knife away from you at this stage?
You know, we'll just bring it back further this way.
We did feel bad about it, but also at the time when we were told there was actually nothing we could do and we just needed to actually progress with the challenge because we were on restricted time. And what was done was done. We couldn't resurrect those crays and then kill them again, which might have been worse.
No, there's no way. They were well and truly dead.
Yeah.
So shellfish and things like that, they've got no nervous system. That's not an issue for...
No, they've got no nervous system. They supposedly can't feel anything. But then, you know, a vegan would have you believe a bunch of celery has a feeling. So...
Because that's the other thing. I mean, you hear this... I mean, again, looking at all the comments of the story today, people saying, oh, this is PC. You're a PC obsessive. You're politically correct. Did you know that?
I'm PC obsessive?
That's right, because that's what... Because you can't... And people saying, we've done it for ages, therefore it must be right.
And it's a generational thing. It has been done. It's been done in batches and homes throughout New Zealand.
If you were camping, you know, or you're on a boat and you don't have access to a fridge, you can't chill it down, is the knife straight in still the best way of...
It's still the best. They're the two ways. Either chill it down and bring it out and cut it with knife, or simply, if you're on the boat and you haven't got access to a fridge or anything like that, just steady, boy.
All right.
Steady. Then you just simply take the knife and kill it the most humane way as possible. Don't leave it hanging around in the sun. You know, when we export rock lobsters around the world, we export them in nice shaved chips and everything else.
Yeah.
And keep them in the dark. Look after them.
OK. Show us then, if you wouldn't mind, Peter, the correct way to put this guy out of his, humanely.
Let's name him.
No, we're not going to name him.
Rocky the Rock Lobster.
We'll call him Dave Camille.
You hold that for me, please.
The knife?
Yeah, yeah,
oh,
hold
God.
The knife. OK, so first thing you do is you open up his tail.
Yeah.
And you grab him absolutely firmly on the tail, just in front of the back of his head. OK, you take the knife, come down from his middle horn.
Yep.
Down to about there.
Yeah.
Remember, you're going to go straight down. This is a big lobster, so his shell's going to be quite tough.
Yep.
So you go straight down.
Oh!
There we go.
So that's it.
That's it. And there'll be a little rigor mortis will happen.
But that lobster is not fair. That crayfish is not feeling anything now.
I'm a little girl. I don't know if I could even do that.
He's absolutely gone now.
Yeah.
And that's the most humane way. There is no other way. And, you know, I get really upset when people don't look after their ingredients. You know, it's a wee bit of a cliche. They've died, you've killed them, they've given up their life so you can walk upright on the planet.
And that's, I mean, like Ray McVinnie said last night, isn't it? You respect any good chef, respects their ingredients.
Yes.
Speaking of which, I mean, what are you cooking at home now?
A lot of baby food.
Yeah.
I am. Not for me, though, for my son.
Yeah.
We're still cooking meals, basic dinner meals at the moment.
Look, the other thing, we talked about being brutal last night.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the reason of being brutal was they brought in three people who everyone thought had gone.
Yes, they did.
Who edged you guys out. Were you a bit grumpy about that?
I don't think anybody could be happy about that because we had just been slogging it out and... You kind of feel a bit had or a bit replaced, but at the end of the day, they did cook well. They did cook well, but they also had been seeing their families and were a bit more well-rested than the rest of us, though. So, but, you know, I've just got to keep proving myself from there as well.
Do you think the crayfish, the boiling of the crayfish, had any influence on you guys getting bumped out?
At the end of the day, with the show, it comes down to whose dish is the yummiest and whose isn't. The crayfish may have had some of the influence in there, but at the end of the day, we didn't cook the best food, so we went home.
Yeah, I mean, you'd say the same.
I would say exactly the same. I mean, the black team cooked great food on the day. They really showed some grit and some determination. They had a one-shot chance, and when your back's to the wall and you have one shot, boy, you come out fighting, and they came out fighting.
Hey, listen, thanks, guys. And look, just a reminder, again, as we saw, Peter told us, with the cray, you go back from the middle right down to the start of the tail and, about a centimetre in?
Yeah, about a centimetre.
And then the cut goes straight through. And that's the most humane way to prepare your crayfish. But they're certainly too yummy not to eat, aren't they?
They certainly are.
We're going to be arguing over where this one's going next. Hey, thanks very much.
As I said before the clip, how can any vegan possibly promote humane killing of animals for our pleasure? Hurting an animal is always wrong. We heard how people enjoy killing animals, and surprise, surprise, they've found an excuse to keep doing it. They've discovered the amazing, quote, humane way to kill the animal, see? You just have to cut through their heads with a massive knife the correct way, and then everything is A-OK. Let's get stuck into our happy meat. Hurting an animal is always wrong. I hope you'll join me in promoting veganism. Thank you for listening to Coexisting with Non-Human Animals. You can find the script for this episode, as well as downloads for every episode of Coexisting with Non-Human Animals, at coexistingwithnonhumananimals.blogspot.com. If you want to contact me, even just to say you've listened, send an email to jwontdart@gmail.com or on Twitter, twitter.com/jwontdart. I'd appreciate it. Thank you for listening.
Away from the notion of animals as things and toward the moral personhood of animals. The choice is ours. If you're not vegan, go vegan. It's easy. It's better for you. It's certainly better for the planet. And most importantly, it's the morally right thing to do.